My name is Erica Swinney. I'm 39 years old, and today is February 25th, 2016. And we are at the Chicago Cultural Center, and I am here talking to my father, Dan Swinney, and boss, Dan Swinney.
My name is Dan Swinney. I'm 71 years old. Today is the 25th of February, and we're at the Cultural Center, and I'm talking and having a dialogue with my daughter, Erica Swinney.
So we're here to talk about, first of all, you've had an amazing career. You've been an activist, an organizer for, in some shape or form, for the last 45 years of your life. And we also now work together with the organization Manufacturing Renaissance. But I really wanted to take the time today to talk about, how did you get here? How did we end up here? Yeah. How did you get here?
So I was, on how I got here, I just felt, first of all, I was just sort of born to a family at just the right time in history that, to me. So I've had a sort of a fascinating life full of great influences and great opportunities and great challenges. And, I've tried to make the most of it. I was raised by two parents, your grandparents, Olive and Dan Swinney, who were both, sort of good Democrats, good Christians. They were products of, they both went to the University of Chicago School of Social Administration and graduated there. That's where they met. And they had they were sort of the cutting edge and part of the leadership of the New Deal. They both studied social work and then went and worked with the Roosevelt administration in Washington. And, they had a very strong sense of fairness, of community awareness, and sort of engagement and leading a strong life. And as parents, I was just thinking about, preparing, thinking of this interview, they were very permissive. These were people who taught me how to live by modeling how an adult should function as opposed to telling me what to do. I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., where they both worked, in housing and health. Our background wasn't particularly like political or particularly activist, but just filled with solid virtues, and sort of social consciousness and fairness and justice. As a kid, I went to, as it turns out, and this was the 60s, so as I went to high school, or junior high school, in my school in 1959, Stratford Junior High was the first school that was integrated in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And it was something like I had just no knowledge of what was going on in life, but all of a sudden one day there's, hundreds of policemen and a great deal of controversy, and, four black students were integrating our school, and all of a sudden my friends who were, never had discussed these issues were, there's derogatory references to what was going on, and arguments about how do you respond to this and what is going on. For the first time, I was asked, would you marry the N-word? And, of course, I responded just intuitively, yes, but it was a polarizing situation that I, was one of my first experiences. And as a kid, I made a point, even though I didn't view myself as political or an activist of any kind, I made a point to befriend the students in the school and to be, but that was part of normal life. My career path, I was going to be, start out just wanting to be a veterinarian. And I worked for a veterinarian for many years, and, that was going to be my career path. And I went to college in 1963 with that as my purpose. I went to a small school in Michigan, Alma College. And there I just, became, and up to that point, I was pretty nondescript. I was, probably a C student or D student in high school, not particularly motivated. But at Alma College, I got introduced to folk music, which was sort of the opening of a different world. Became sort of intellectually alive, and studying, things. And then all of a sudden Selma happened. And on the student body of the small campus, I had friends who were folk musicians, but, African-American from Detroit, and said, we ought to do something about what's going on in Selma. And, I just sort of followed along and said, sure, that we should do this. And we got together, and a couple of us decided, well, we ought to take a petition from Alma College to Lansing, Michigan, and say that we're in support, we want federal troops or, the federal support for people in the South. And we thought nothing would happen. It would be two or three of us that would get involved. And instead, when we announced where I have a meeting, 200 people showed up at the meeting. A cross was burned in the campus yard. There were fights between black and white students. And the next morning, 50 of us started out to march to Lansing, Michigan, a 50-mile march. And that was the beginning of my activist career. And we were turned around by the state police and had lots of arguments and sang songs. And but it was my introduction to sort of the movement of the 60s, and that's the way things were. That summer, I just was deeply curious about what was going on in the South. And so I went to, got a full-time job working in Atlanta, Georgia, but my whole intent of going to Georgia was to, you know, volunteer and become active in the civil rights movement. And so I started, I contacted the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which was, and just offered to lick stamps and had a car, I'd be a chauffeur, just whatever I could do to be help, to help. So I started working on weekends and evenings in the SNCC office. And that was really the start of, you know, engagement. From that, I ended up, you know, after being a chauffeur from lead organizers, I ended up taking over their project in rural or outside of Atlanta, focused on school desegregation. Ironically, after my experience at my own high school, had my first experience in jail and you know, witnessed Southern justice and the way it worked, which was sort of a life-changing experience. And from then, I sort of decided I had a different future than being a veterinarian, and I transferred to the University of Wisconsin and became very active in the, sort of the student movement of the, you know, the mid-60s in Madison. And I think what was interesting is in Madison, I switched from veterinary medicine to history. And in terms of my own thinking, studying history gave me confidence. It gave me a perspective that was had a broader range than just what was going on. And so it gave me confidence in the path that I was sort of choosing, a path of activism and organizing. And, you know, I was trying to figure out what my career was going to be. And I went and talked to somebody at the social work school and asked, where can you use the experiences I'd learned in the civil rights movement and working in social work? And they said, there's no school that's going to teach you to be a revolutionary. And so then I decided, rather than go to graduate school, I'd go into production, go into start working in industry, you know, maybe become part of the labor movement. And that's, you know, that's where sort of my adult career began.
Wow. So going from Virginia to Michigan, down to Selma, back to Wisconsin, and you made a decision upon graduation to go into labor movement. So where did you, how did you get to Chicago?
Well, I left Madison. I moved to Waukegan, and it was sort of the intent of going to work and going to work in production and, you know, being part of, you know, working people and what their life was like. And so I started working in, you know, several factories in the Waukegan, North Chicago area, you know, and got my first taste. The first company I worked at, a small company called Reliance Universal, made paint. And it was a non-union shop. I was making $2.25 an hour, and which is not too much money. And at one point, I helped organize my first action. We all signed a petition, and we signed it in a circle. So we couldn't, the boss couldn't tell who signed the petition first and identify the leadership, and we asked for a 25-cent raise and walked into the office with our petition with about, you know, 10 or 15 workers and got our 25-cent raise. And it was my first, labor experience. And then I actually, after a couple of years, you know, after working there in a number of factories, I moved to Chicago in 1970, 1971, mm-hmm. and spent, you know, the next 13 years as a machinist and sort of an independent union organizer. I worked at Sunbeam on the west side, and all my work was on the west side of Chicago on Roosevelt Road between Cicero and Austin. And I worked at Sunbeam, and I tried to organize a union there and got fired, and, you know, based on all my mistakes. So I won a labor board case and bought a new car with my settlement and got married and then worked at another place. And I spent, you know, 7 years working at a company called Taylor Forge in Cicero, on 14th and Cicero, where I was successful in organizing a steelworker, a local of the Steelworkers Union, and was, you know, served as the leadership of that.
Wow. And you, so I know you and Mom lived on the west side of Chicago, right, for a while. Like, so how, like, when were you there? Where did that fit in the work that you were doing when you were living on the west side? And because that's where I grew up. That's my first memories, is living in, growing up in Humboldt Park.
Right. We first moved to Chicago. Well, I moved to Maywood, actually, when I first moved to Chicago, but then I started working in sort of industry, and then I met your mom. And when I was working, I moved from Maywood into Chicago and to the Austin community on Chicago's west side, to a little flat above a bar at Parkside in Chicago, and then I met your mother, and we dated, and she was a graduate of Elmhurst College, and she moved in, and then one night, I mean, at that point, Chicago Avenue was a dividing line between blacks and whites, and we lived above a hillbilly bar that was singing the stylistics, so the sounds would waft through the floor every morning. And but one week we had, I think, shootings outside the apartment, like three nights in 1 week. And wow. So then we moved to a safer community, Humboldt Park, And during that time, I was, I used to, travel to, I was working in industry, so I either by public transportation or by car, I'd drive to the, the west side down on Roosevelt Road and work. And we got, so at, when we lived on Parkside, we got married at Third Unitarian Church in Austin. And then later on moved on to Humboldt Park where you were born.
Mm-hmm. So how did the organization start? How did Manufacturing Renaissance start?
In my own company. So, when I first went into manufacturing, I sort of had a view of having a career path to be in the labor movement. I'd become, an effective organizer, and I, began to work periodically on the staff of the Steelworkers Union to help organize other plants. And, I thought there was a pretty clear trajectory that I would, simply go into, be hired by the Steelworkers Union or something or some equivalent union.
And why manufacturing? Like, why was manufacturing so important to you at that time? Like, why did you pick that as sort of an industry or sector to really focus on?
Well, sort of just my understanding of history. It was sort of interesting. I didn't have a very specific view. I felt working people, if you're going to, my experience of working in the South in the civil rights movement, my activism as a student meant I was really focused on, we needed a much better, fairer, juster, more productive system. And, that's what I was interested in from the very beginning. And I think my study of history sort of encouraged that. In other words, to look at things that were going on as systemic problems, not simply a desire to help poor people or help working people. So I went into, manufacturing just knowing in a sort of a pretty nice sense that if you're going to be involved in social change, you needed to be involved with people who work and not just be a social service provider or not just be an advocate. And that was a world that I needed to understand. And I was interested in production. And I had some vague view about the labor movement. So it was really, just understanding, and I think it's still the right view, that if you were going to be involved in societal change and systemic change, you need to be at the place of production, of wealth creation, not just within a superstructure of, sort of the government apparatus or academia. I certainly had no desire to be in academia. So I started out, when I got there, I enjoyed it. I mean, I was a machinist, and first of all, I worked on assembly lines and became a semi-skilled machinist. I enjoyed production. I enjoyed the work. I enjoyed, organizing in that context. I enjoyed the labor movement. And so that's why that was there. What happened in my situation was I had this vision of just simply going on in the labor movement and life would continue as usual. But in the beginning of the late 70s and early 80s, you begin to have this total crisis in manufacturing that caught everybody by surprise. And so I worked next to Cicero, and also we had lots of plant closings and lots of layoffs. And Cicero itself lost 50% of its jobs in 6 years. All the major companies that we were working at were closing. And I was part of the Steelworkers Union, and a leader of a local. And in the Steelworkers Union, there is now threats of layoffs that were actually not threats. Hundreds or thousands of people were getting laid off. You had bargaining situations that were very complex, where companies were asking for concessions. And typically, unions had no clue about how to respond to that demand, whether it was something that could save their job or was it something they were being taken advantage of. And then finally, my company, announced it was going to close. My company closed in 1983 and I lost my job. And this is the beginning of the wave of plant closings. And in Chicago lost 3,000, now 7,000 companies in the 1980s. So, and people were debating, was this the end of manufacturing? And because clearly what was going on was huge and it was having a huge impact. And, I actually didn't know the answer to that question, but I knew there should be an answer as an organizer. Is this a viable sector? Are these companies where we could, in fact, do something to keep them open? Or was there some kind of fundamental change that we should just walk away from manufacturing and that our society was going to be some kind of different kind of society? So I actually created this organization. It was first called the Midwest Center for Labor Research in 1983. And our purpose was to answer that question. Is manufacturing dead? Or is there something we can do to save it? Because clearly the loss of manufacturing jobs was creating enormous poverty, enormous insecurity. And so I started the organization then. Actually, I raffled off a bottle of whiskey at a Labor Day picnic, and that was my first fundraising effort. I worked for a year without any pay, but began to put together a team of people to focus on this issue. And as we formed, and we were mostly formed by labor leaders and community leaders with a few academics from Roosevelt University and elsewhere, we then it coincided with the election of Harold Washington, and I was part of the Harold Washington campaign. And Harold Washington as a mayor was interested in sort of new approaches. And so we became an organization that worked for the city and became sort of the SWAT team that looked at companies in crisis and to look for options for the city and trying to save these companies. So that's how my work got started.
So I remember when I first So I was, during this time, I know, I was a little girl, and I could care less about what your manufacturing was, or I was not focused on those kinds of issues at that time. But in retrospect, you know, as I've come part of the work, you know, you've told me some incredible stories of, like, so some of those plants that the company intervened. And so can you talk about a little bit, like, what were some of the companies that you were working to help save manufacturing jobs and keeping them in Chicago?
Yeah, like I said, we were seen as the organization to go to if a company had announced a closing or there were layoffs or there's some kind of evidence that the company was in crisis. And again, we were worked for the city of Chicago for the Department of Development, but we also were called in by unions and community organizations and others in those circumstances. And what we would do is simply go into a particular company and look at it and make the try to make the assessment. Is this a company that's viable or not? Is there a problem the company has that could be solved or not? You know, as a way to and we developed quite a bit of skill as being able to analyze businesses, but we did it with a social through the sort of a lens of social interests, because lots of people were desperate. A company would announce it was planning to close, and people would sometimes even try to buy the company, but the company would close anyhow. And it, you know, so we tried to help people have a detached view, an informed view about how to respond to this. So having said that, you know, we looked at you know, some companies, you know, and I probably looked at scores of companies, you know, both and mostly in Chicago, but also some around the country in Minnesota and, you know, the East Coast and West Coast. And we found some companies that really should have closed, you know, that they really had a product or a process that was way beyond repair. And we, it was useful for us to say, this is not, there's nothing we can do to stop this company from closing, and people need to move on and do the best they can in the transition. But having said that, we looked at, you know, a number of major companies in Chicago, like Stuart Warner over on Diversity Avenue, which is, you know, was a company that employed 1,800 people. It was, we got called in by the union that was being asked for concessions. We looked at the company, and they were, you know, claiming a crisis, and they were claiming that workers were paid too much and the workers had to give up their wages. And we looked at the company, and we found a board of directors that was average age 80. They were a company that had no debt. They're sitting on like $20 million in cash. It was clearly a company that was just where the owners were just getting ready to sell it and really make a killing in the real estate value. So it was a company that was viable. And so we actually worked and worked with the union and with entrepreneurs to try to offer an effort to purchase the company. And it was a company that could have stayed open. We looked at Brock Candy Company, which was a major company in crisis during the 80s, and it employed some 3,700 people on the west side of Chicago. Again, when we looked at the company, it was a company that was really being destroyed by an owner who had every interest of making more money by moving the company to Mexico or Argentina. And so we worked on behalf of the union to try to, you know, to save that company. But even more interesting, I mean, people think about manufacturing, they think about large companies, but 90% of manufacturing companies have less than 100 employees. And we began to find that companies were closing because you had an aging owner. And we found out that in manufacturing, like 99% of the companies are owned by whites. And so a pattern would be a guy would start a company in, let's say, Humboldt Park after the Korean War. And as the community changed, as he became wealthy and moved to the suburbs, and it was now time to retire. And there was nobody in the family to buy the company, and so the company would close. And so we found a company like that in Inglewood and helped the employees buy the company. And we found out that was a huge issue. We did a study for the city of 800 companies and found that 40% were at risk of closing only because of the succession of ownership.
Wow.
And we helped employees buy the companies. We helped Black and Latino entrepreneurs buy the companies. So my whole experience, first of all, led me to the conclusion that I think we could have saved about 80% of the losses we had during the 80s and 90s if labor, business, government, community had been sort of more proactive and more creative. So I came to the conclusion manufacturing was viable. It's should be the foundation for our society. It was worth the fight. And that was sort of a major, you know, sort of the work, what I came to conclusion with in the first, you know, 15 or so years of my work.
So in that time, so you were sort of just getting this huge amount of understanding and experience and engaging in all these various levels. I mean, the thing I found always interesting is that you weren't just working with workers, you were also working with the management of these companies. It wasn't just about taking over. It really was building a new kind of a new structure for a company to be run. And that was really inclusive. It was, you know, really having a lot of engagement from community-based organizations, community leaders as part of And that's something you just don't, you just, because when you think of jobs closing or it feels so powerless. And I think right. some of the work that I know that has sort of, as I became to understand what the organization was doing, was just like, wow, it's being incredibly proactive. It's not just saying, oh, there goes another one and there's not much we can do. It was saying, no, we can really redefine how we have business and economic and community development. And I know the time, you know, so going into, as our story goes into the 90s, so I was in college, I moved out to California, right. still oblivious, really. I remember as a, you know, if anybody asked me what you did, I never could really explain it. I was like, something with factories and maybe labor unions is probably as much as I knew, but then your work really progressed. So you started getting interested in issues of education. So why is that? Like, so what, cause that then I come to work for you a little bit after your education work got off the ground, but talk a little bit about why education and manufacturing?
Well, let me step back a bit to what you were coming on earlier. In other words, as we looked at companies and looked at many of them that are closing, we found some companies were sort of intentionally being closed by people in the business community, Wall Street in particular. Others, large publicly traded companies, and my own company was a good example, is when you had new computer technology and new technologies, you found people who were invested in manufacturing could make more money elsewhere. So traditional investors in manufacturing actually began to pull out their revenue from manufacturing companies. So there you could really point to a bad guy. But in many cases, like the issue of succession of ownership, you had owners who simply couldn't find a person to buy their company, and they ended up liquidating, you know, their company and getting 20% of its value, when if they had a purchaser in place, somebody could have paid them for the value of their business, and they would have gotten 100% of their return on investment. So we began to find, as we realized manufacturing is viable, and there really wasn't, you know, only an evil force, but just problems with society, we could work. We found a lot of manufacturing companies and owners of companies that wanted to work with us. In other words, that we could segment the world of corporate America into what we called a high road and a low road, or people who really were part of the problem versus a large number of people, including owners of companies, that wanted to be part of the solution. So we began to realize that we could build, and our work was, even around plant closings, was never anti-business or anti-corporate. It was also offering a good business strategy versus a bad business strategy, and that's where we framed it. But to your point, we recognized in really the 1990s that also manufacturing was changing in the sense that a lot of low-skilled work was going offshore. You know, it wasn't all jobs going to China and Mexico, but it was the jobs that were low-skilled because, you know, China and Mexico had a low-skilled workforce that was willing to work for one-tenth of the wages here. So our companies in Chicago and around the country began to shift to doing more complex work using more sophisticated technology. And they found they simply couldn't find the talent they needed to do the work. Because we'd also had a corresponding deindustrialization of our school system where, you know, the notion of vocational education or working with your hands was all seen as a pejorative thing, a negative thing, a tracking thing for, you know, young people of color. So in 2000, we actually, with the Chicago Federation of Labor, we did a major study on the relationship of public education to the manufacturing sector, and we found out that our public school system and our city college system was really totally disconnected from manufacturing, which meant you had literally thousands of jobs going unfilled because the school system wasn't providing young people with skills and education to be successful in even going into entry-level jobs. And on the other hand, you have thousands of kids eager for jobs. We're talking about the beginning of urban poverty. So we began to recognize that first of all, we knew how important our manufacturing sector was. We knew that it was viable and could compete, but it had to have an educational infrastructure that served that system. And if you had a good public education system that served that system, that would benefit the public, mm-hmm. that young people could get jobs. And so we started work where we did the study and also understood what was going on internationally. We went to Europe and studied European best practice and came back to the city and proposed dramatic changes in our education system. And this was done actually in partnership with the Chicago Federation of Labor. And that included really utilizing a lot of the practices that were common in Europe of having national skills certifications, creating a closer partnership between the private sector and public education, and so on and so forth. So our work then, we did the major study, offered a program for reform. that was interesting. Even though we were sort of a labor-affiliated group, our proposal for reform was embraced by, for example, the Illinois Manufacturers Association, an organization was deeply Republican and deeply anti-labor, but they recognized the value of the work, that we were really identifying a real problem that faced manufacturers, and they offered to work with us. And so we, at that point, created a coalition that you became familiar with, of the Chicago Manufacturing Renaissance Council, of a coalition of labor and business and community and and educators. And the first project of that coalition was the creation of Austin Polytech Academy, a public high school, geared towards meeting the standards of, what we're now, what we call advanced manufacturing companies, in terms of what they needed for people, the kinds of skills people needed to do the work. But it was also a school that was embedded in the west side of Chicago, a community that was, faced the challenges of poverty and, and violence and so on and so forth. So, and that was sort of when you became aware of what I was doing. And maybe one last thing, by the way, I felt even as a parent, you and your mother, we were very deliberate about, we didn't direct you on what to think. I rarely took you to picket lines or to told you about what I did, because I felt, I'd learned from my own parents, it's better to model what you do, and sooner or later your kids will catch up if they're interested. But if you try to impose your politics on your kids, they're going to hate you forever.
No, so. It's true. I think because when I was, I finished high school in 94, and then I went out to UC Berkeley for college, and where I graduated in 98. And pretty much that whole decade, my interest, because of all of the, the great, you and mom provided a great childhood, and we had a lot of great experiences camping and being outdoors, and I wanted to be a biologist, an ecologist. And so when I went off to college, I had all intention of, doing that. And everything from marine biology to herpetology and beyond. But then I went into the Peace Corps in the late 90s. Yeah, and I think that is when we had our first real conversation, when you came down to visit when I was in Paraguay.
Well, I think the first thing, I got a letter from you saying, "So, Dad, I'm talking to this guy who's a peasant organizer, and I'm trying to explain to him high road and low road and what you're doing. And could you explain this to me so I can maybe..." So that's why I remember the discussion started. Right. And then I came down to visit you.
Because it wasn't just, it was the concept, but then it was also trying to explain it not only in Spanish, but in their indigenous language, Guarani, which was even more complicated. So I was like, oh my God, how am I going to explain? Because they essentially had the assumption that pretty much all Americans were just, it was just a country full of just rich people trying to get richer. And I just remember that was the first moment I reflected. I was like, wait a second. I don't think my dad is like that. I think my dad is doing something different, but I can't quite explain. And that was really the first time I remember being genuinely interested. I'm like, oh, what does my dad do? I don't really. So, but when you came down and visited, that's when we first talked about, all these issues about why it was. And I remember it was like 3 days solid talking of like, why is the world the way it is? And
well, I can add to that in the sense that, I mean, the second letter that I remember, there's, obviously used to write home regularly, but the second theme that emerged was, this guy I've been working with, he accused me of being a spy, that the Peace Corps, if I was in the Peace Corps, I must be a spy. Am I a spy? So then I
didn't know.
Yeah, no, it was really a sort of non-rhetorical question. Mm-hmm. And so so to me, this is a really rich turning point in our history. So I went to visit you in Paraguay, and you picked me up at Asuncion, and we got on a bus and went for 5 hours back into the countryside. And what was interesting, we were talking, his name was?
Basilio.
Basilio, yeah. Right. And so we go, you lived as a Peace Corps volunteer back in the bush. It wasn't even a town. It was simply a road, and it was just an area that was on the edge of, just of the bush. And I think when we got there, and you and I talked, and we got to the village, and I think within 5 minutes, Basilio was in your compound and wanted to talk.
Yeah.
And so for the next was 3 or 4 days, what was fascinating to me is I got to see you. First of all, you were there. You'd been in the Peace Corps for a year. You were part of a community. You were working with teachers on environmental mm-hmm. issues. You had standing. You had status. You were a professional. You were an organizer in a broader sense of the word. You were engaged. And I'd never seen you in that way. Up to that point, I'd really known you only as a high school student. I didn't really, I knew you through college, but we didn't have day-to-day contact. But then they were, the people you were working with were activists, and they were very interested in my ideas. And They spoke Guarani. They didn't even speak Spanish. I mean, or they didn't want to speak Spanish. So you were my translator. And it was a highly political kind of environment.
Yeah.
And so for 3 days, all we did was talk politics, and you were my translator. And so I found that in the discussion, first of all, it was just interesting. And I think then you became exposed to me and sort of the depth of my ideas and my thinking and how it resonated in that community. And then finally, it was really interesting because one of the questions was that, you know, am I a spy? And you and I were taking the bus back to Asuncion. And I was trying to explain to you how you can be part of, that the Peace Corps was part of the American foreign policy. And in many cases, it played a role in the intelligence community, which maybe was benign, but still was a role. How that even, you know, that whoever, when you're part of an agency, you report on what's going on, and those reports could be, you know, used for any number of reasons. And as we went from the bus into the Peace Corps office, you know, your boss, who's also a really good guy, was simply saying, well, I've been using these reports and trying to figure out who are the leaders. I mean,
right.
it was a discussion that just reflected exactly what concerns should have been. But anyhow, that was the beginning of our discussions.
Yeah.
Our political, you know, our working relationship.
Yeah. And then I still went a little farther down my path. I went back to California and I ended up completing a master's in plant ecology. I was, you know, but became increasingly more interested in environmental justice, social justice issue. All the experience I had in Paraguay really kind of put me on this path. But finally, I know it came down to coming back to Chicago after several years working as an organizer out in the San Francisco and Central Valley. Mm-hmm. That's when I first really also became interested in issues of manufacturing and community development, and
right.
really saw very well. I was working with a farm worker community in Central California, and they were fighting one of the largest hazardous waste facilities, you know, this community, Kettleman City. And it was in that context where I first realized that how, you know, this community or this county really had chosen hazardous waste as its economic development strategy.
Right.
And that's when I first really, the light bulb went off for me about how manufacturing can be part of a community-driven economic development strategy. And that's when also I know I was, and that's when Austin Polytech was coming online in Chicago.
Yeah,
so,
right.
yeah.
So, yeah, because, I mean, in my own transition, you know, I mean, maybe this makes the linkage, is that once I understood that, you know, manufacturing was viable, and there are a large number of people, including manufacturers, that wanted to solve the problems that were creating the crisis at all levels, then it became part of a development strategy. How do we not only retain companies or focus on individual companies, but how do we rebuild this fabric, including an educational infrastructure? And that, so it became very much of a proactive strategy. I began as a person reacting to plant closings and then became a proponent of an aggressive, proactive strategy for community development that had a number of different aspects. And so we did start, one of the first project we started was a high school. In a high school we started, Austin Polytech was modeled after an example in Spain. In Spain, there's a town called Mondragon, which is a center for cooperatives and manufacturing. And in fact, it's one of the most vibrant industrial regions in all of Europe. And as we studied it, it began with a polytechnical school of teaching. You know, it was a very poor community, rural community with very little manufacturing. But a priest started a school that taught young people the technical aspects of manufacturing, of, you know, machining, engineering, and so on and so forth, but also infused them with Catholic social teaching, different values. And then in 10 years, some of those students bought the first company, their first manufacturing company, and organized as a cooperative. One worker, one vote. The highest paid didn't make more than three times the lowest paid. And then that one company has now become a network of 100 companies employing 130,000 people. I mean, it was a vision of development. So we started Austin Polytech with that vision of development in mind. I mean, Austin Polytech isn't a vocational school. It wasn't just about going into just menial jobs or production jobs.
And I remember at the time when I was even still in California, in San Francisco, where there's a lot of, you know, progressive work underway. And I just remember I didn't know anything, any other project like
right.
what you were doing with Austin Polytech. And I was really intrigued of like, wow, this is... And that was part of my interest in moving back to Chicago, which I did. And you offered me a job right away. So I was really grateful to have the chance to, essentially, Austin Polytech was just starting its first year. And
right.
I came on board to help initially, really just to help with community outreach and community engagement. But then it turned more into actually building the program, which I wasn't expecting, but has, you know, since become, for me, the work of a lifetime. It's been the last 8 years. building this program literally from scratch that is literally connecting young people to these career pathways in manufacturing and part of really building this next generation of leadership in this field in a way that you've been sort of envisioning for the last, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's right. So you came in and so you've been our project director in the school and now manage a staff of 11 people. And, and we are now, and it's a project that is now, we did what we said we would do by understanding the crisis in manufacturing and that it had solutions. There were solutions to that crisis. It wasn't some inevitable problem that nobody could solve. We then identified an area where we could intervene in terms of creating an educational infrastructure that met the needs of companies, but also included, residents from the West Side. So now, and we took on a partnership with public schools. It is a public school, which has been a complicated process.
Yeah.
But we now have young people in the West Side of Chicago making 75, one guy made $75,000 last year as a skilled machinist.
Yeah.
Another kid is now a supervisor in a company and has keys to the factory. We have kids getting full rides into engineering. This is from the Austin community. But to me, what's interesting about it, and what to me that's why our work has been on, is that we've created a prototype, and now we've sort of tested: can it take hold?
Right.
And then can it really lead to institutional change, not just in Austin, but in the city and in the country?
Yeah, we're at an interesting moment right now because. The work that you've sort of spearheaded, really, identifying this what is now called the skills gap. I mean, you were really talking about these issues 10 years before everybody else. And I think through our practical work of actually starting and growing this program the way we have, we are actively influencing a lot of people about what's possible. And I think we're now at a point to see, we'll see in the next 5 to 10 years, is this work really lead to institutional change? Can we really build the kind of education and workforce development system that actually leads to young people of color really not just working for manufacturing companies, but really being the next generation of owners and leaders in the world, as far as I'm concerned?
So my question is, so why have you stuck with it? What did you find, and what is it different than what you originally thought you would do to what you're doing? And where are you going to be in the next 10 years?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, this has been phenomenal. I mean, this work has been, for me, there are almost no words to describe it. It's been deeply, deeply, it's been a profound experience for me. And to be able to play a leadership role, essentially, in building something that I think really has the potential to make a real change in Austin and also in communities like Austin everywhere. So for me, from the West Side, being African American, really, being an organizer, being somebody who really wants to be part of the solution, I really feel like what you've started and now what I'm contributing to is, creating, like you said, a prototype that really can profoundly change how we think as a society of education and economic development.
Yeah. I mean, to me, because I am sort of at the end of my career and, approaching it.
Not quite.
I told Pam I'm going to live to be 105, but I see right now the important thing is we did lock into something that is talking about systemic change and it works. And so I see my role. I mean, to me, what's exciting is that not only have you begun to embrace, do you continue the work to work on these kinds of issues, but we now have young graduates.
That's right.
We have the Young Manufacturers Association. I now am, working as an organizer, just like I did, 40 years ago with young people talking about, and these are young people who are now working in manufacturing companies or trying to work. They have actually secure careers. They're open to big ideas. They're the same age I was when I went first to the South. And now I view my role, and it's actually fun because it is working, of transferring what I learned over the last 45 years to them as both how to be successful, not only just as a worker and to have a good job, but also how to be a leader and talk about social change and be part of really, approaching the challenges of our society and the opportunities that are present. So it's
so exciting. And so you're influencing two generations now, myself, my generation, as well as these young people who've come out of this program that we've created. So.
Yeah. And there could, many times, and to have the chance to work with my daughter, for us to work so closely on such complicated issues, and to and be somewhat successful to boot has been really one of the most exciting aspects of, you know, my entire life. So
we're a great team.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks, Dad.
Thanks.